Well, if you want to follow along with this, then we're looking at the second half of Daniel chapter 11. This is the most detailed prophecy in the scripture, one of the longest prophecies in the scripture. We mentioned that last time, I think. And we went through the first half of chapter 11, the last time we looked at Daniel, and this will be our last voyage into the book of Daniel, unless somebody has any questions or would like to look at some other chapters or events. Chapter 12 is really interesting, as are some of the other chapters that we haven't covered. Chapter 10 is very interesting, but we haven't had time really to delve into it. We're in the second half of Daniel chapter 11. This is a very detailed prophecy, as I've mentioned, so you'll have to bear with me. We won't read all the verses, but hopefully you can follow along as we cover the history of how these things unfolded in history. Daniel writing hundreds of years before these events took place, and yet they unfolded precisely as he prophesied, or as God prophesied through him. So we're going to look at Daniel chapter 11. Verses 21 to 45. Remember, we're in the 6th century BC, 600 years before Christ. Some of these events weren't going to unfold for hundreds of years after Daniel wrote down these words, after this prophecy was given to him. So we're in the 6th century BC. Daniel, as you know, is in Persia. Babylon has gone now. It's the empire of the Medes and the Persians that are in control, that they're the major power in world affairs right now. And Daniel is beside the river Tigris, and he's given this vision. We can't really look at the detail in chapter 10, we referred to it last time, but he's given a vision, and he's promised a vision of the future, and with particular interest in, of course, the Jewish nation, but going beyond that also to God's people as events unfolded later on, many years later, the time of Christ, the apostles, and beyond that to our day, and beyond this day. And so he's been given this vision of the future, and we've already seen a vision of the four great empires that were to arise. Daniel has described them in great detail, and he's also given us the interpretation of who the first three are. The fourth is obvious, because you only have to pick up a history book and you know exactly what follows on from the empire of the Greeks. So we saw the image of Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2 of Daniel. We looked at that. We saw how that image pictured for us four empires that would arise. And we also saw the vision that Daniel himself saw of the four beasts, which again pictured those same four empires. That's the empire of Babylon, which was the head of gold on Nebuchadnezzar's image, and the first of the beasts that Daniel sees, followed by the empire of the Medes and the Persians, which was again followed by the empire of Greece. And as I mentioned, although Daniel doesn't give us the interpretation, we know that the empire that followed Greece is the Roman Empire. We know that. And so these four empires are clearly spelled out for us in this prophecy. We've already seen some of those things already. The Empire of Greece, as we saw again, was divided into four power blocks, if you like. It was fought over by Alexander's generals after Alexander died. He actually died in Babylon. I think we've mentioned that when he was still a young man. He drunk himself to death, effectively, because he had nothing else to do with his life. He'd accomplished everything. But the empire was divided among his generals. They fought over it. Eventually, the four most powerful generals won, and the empire became four separate power blocks. But this prophecy focuses on two of those power blocks, the ones that influence Palestine in particular and have a particular bearing upon the Jewish nation. And those two power blocks are the ones that arose through Ptolemy, who was a close friend of Alexander's. He was actually the person who took the body of Alexander when he died and had him buried in the city of Alexandria, which Alexander had founded. So he established his empire in Egypt, and that territory that spills beyond that. And one of his one of the princes who was allied with him, a man called Seleucus, became so powerful that he established his own empire in the north, in Syria. So the Seleucid kingdom was in the north, and the Ptolemy's kingdom was in the south. So you had the kings of the north, the Seleucids, and they lasted way into the future, until the Maccabean period. And then the empire in the south, the empire of the Ptolemies, which lasted beyond that to the time of Cleopatra. The Cleopatra that we know from history, the famous Cleopatra, who was the Cleopatra the seventh of Egypt, and the only Greek ruler in Egypt who actually took the trouble to learn the Egyptian language. She actually was proud of the fact that she was queen of Egypt and took it all on board and wanted to fully immerse herself in Egyptian culture as well as Greek culture. So we've seen all of that already. We saw the history of these two kingdoms unfold. We saw that last time in the first half of this chapter. We saw how the history unfolded. So there were constant wars and then alliances through marriage and agreements that were broken, and then more wars and so on. And it was a pattern that continued and continued and continues still as we get into the second half of this chapter. And all of these things, as I mentioned, came to pass hundreds of years later, just exactly as Daniel describes them here. God is in control. We mentioned this last time, even though in the first half of this chapter, he isn't even mentioned. But God is still there. He's there in all of this, controlling all these events, bringing all these things to pass, because he is the God of history. God controls history. That's why we need to have no fear about the future or the present, because God controls all of these affairs. We see events unfolding in the world. We worry sometimes about where things are leading. But we have to remember that God is in overall control, and the things that he has prophesied in his word, the things that we know are going to come to pass because we believe what is written here, we know that those things will surely come to pass. God is over all. And we saw how the kingdom of the Seleucids in the north became the more dominant of the two kingdoms. We saw the rise of Antiochus the Great. He was Antiochus the Third. He had three sons. I'm going to read of the youngest of his three sons who usurps the throne effectively. Antiochus Epiphanes, as he styled himself. He was Antiochus the Fourth. So we remember last time how on his way to annex Asia Minor, on his way to Italy, Antiochus the Great met his match in the person of a Roman general, Lucius Cornelius Scipio, who had the famous brother Publius Scipio, who was the man who defeated Hannibal. He had this great impact on Roman society, so much so that he started the fashion that people were like him, became clean-shaven. Any man who fancied himself as a real man wanted to be like this Scipio and was clean-shaven. Everywhere else in the world, men generally were bearded, even in Jerusalem, and even in Judea, men were bearded. The Romans started this fashion of a real man being clean-shaven, you know. But that was Scipio. So Antiochus the Great met his match in this Lucius Scipio, the younger brother of Publius, the great Roman general, and he defeated him. And we saw how Antiochus the Great then retreated and died shortly afterwards, it was the brother of Antiochus the Fourth who succeeded Antiochus the Great to the throne, was poisoned. I think we mentioned that last time. It was mysteriously poisoned. He just disappeared off the scene, and suddenly this individual who wasn't the next in line to the throne suddenly usurps the throne. So stepping onto the scene is this Antiochus the Fourth. He styled himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means magnificent one, or glorious one, or God manifest. You know, here's the glory of God manifested in me. That's what the name Epiphanes means. So he called himself Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jews later when he was persecuting them, gave him the nickname Epimenes, which means madman. So he styled himself Epiphanes, they called him Epimenes. He said he was the great one, the glorious one. They said he was the mad one. So here onto the scene comes this individual who is a manifestation of evil. He's an epitome of all things evil. He comes onto the scene as a great despot, a great dictator, and yet he comes onto the scene and usurps the throne through flattery and through flattering language. He makes his way onto the world scene as the ruler of the Seleucid Empire in the north, one of the most vile and detested rulers in all of history, certainly detested by the Jews more than anybody else, with the exception perhaps of Adolf Hitler. But he was detested by the Jews and by many others as well who came into contact with him. So onto the scene comes this vilest of all individuals, Antiochus Epiphanes. And the rest of the chapter, much of the rest of this chapter, focuses on him because he's such an important individual for the history of God's people. So here we have Antiochus Epiphanes stepping onto the scene as the leader of the kingdom in the north. He wasn't in succession to the throne, but he usurps the throne. Here, look at verse 21. I should have read that, shouldn't I, as we were sort of getting into that section. So look at verse 21, and it says, "And in his estate shall stand up a vile person." That's in the estate of his father, who died mysteriously, was poisoned mysteriously. "To whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the throne by flatteries." We just mentioned that. That's how he got the throne, promising, making promises to people, getting friends on side by flattery and pleasing language, smooth talking, if you like. That's how he acquired the throne. Verse 22, one of the first things he did was he routed the Egyptian army. He led an army down south, broke the Egyptian army, and at the same time broke the alliance that had been made by his father with the king of Egypt. That would have been Ptolemy the Fifth, I think, the man who was married to his sister, Cleopatra the First. So he broke that contract. So in the and with the arms of a flood shall they be overthrown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. That's the king of Egypt. This covenant was the covenant that was made with Antiochus' father. This marriage covenant that was entered into, which was supposed to be form an alliance between the two kingdoms. He broke that covenant and routed the Egyptian nation. Verse 23, "And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully." So again, he's betraying the agreement that was made with the king of Egypt. "For he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people." Now that refers to the fact that when he invaded Egypt, there were people in Egypt who favored him, who wanted a strong leader, and obviously for various reasons didn't like the present king of Egypt, Ptolemy the Fifth. And so, as often happens in these situations, there are always a handful of traitors in the country who'll work with the oppressor, who'll work with the intruder, and that's how Antiochus came in and was able to make such inroads into Egypt. That was the start of the rise to Antiochus' power. The fact that he was able to get some powerful friends in Egypt who he was able to work with and through, and that's how he was able to become strong and mighty in the entire region, north and south. He built himself a lavish kingdom in the north. Verse 24, "He shall enter peaceably even upon the fastest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers shall not done, have not done, nor his father's fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. So he waxed mightily and built this lavish kingdom in the north, still retaining ambitions of taking full control of the Egyptian strongholds. Verses 25 and 26 will make mention of that. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south. So he still has this this ambition towards the south, towards annexing Egypt and having the entire region, north and south, as his kingdom. The Egyptian army is utterly defeated by him. And so in verse 27, we find the two kings sit together and try to arrange a peaceful accord. But both of them are working deceitfully. Both of them are out to outdo the other. The two of them are deceitful in their negotiations. And this pretense at sharing power, of course, is just a pretense. And that's because it's not God's time yet for these things to come to an end. It mentions that here in verse 27, I think. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies to one another at the table. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end is not at the appointed time. So it's not God's time yet for peace in the region through these accords. And so nothing came of that. The two men fooled each other, but the rivalry continued. It wasn't God's time as yet. So Antiochus returns home, verse 28. Verse 29, he turns his attention to Egypt once again. He doesn't give up this ambition of controlling the entire region. Then he shall return to his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy... Verse 29? That's right. Verse 28, I meant to read. Then he shall return to his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. At the same appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved. But this happened because he met another, like his father before him, Antiochus the Great. And Antiochus Epiphanes met a match in another Roman general. He's on his way to annex the south again, and he comes up against a Roman fleet. And it's the Roman fleet is captained by a Roman general. These ships of Chittim are Roman ships. This is a Roman fleet that he comes up against. He meets his match. This fleet was commanded by a powerful Roman general. This man was called Gaius Papilius Lanus. Gaius Papilius Lanus, L-A-E-N-U-S. He was twice one of only two, the only two consuls in the Roman Republic. It's a very powerful individual, this man that Antiochus Epiphanes comes up against as he captains this Roman fleet. One of only two consuls in the Roman Republic. There was the emperor, then there were the two consuls, and then the Senate, which the consuls controlled, and then the rest of the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. Very powerful individual. Antiochus meets him on land, comes towards him, holds out his hand to greet this Roman general. The Roman general doesn't shake his hand. He hands him a letter from Rome. The letter is a demand that Antiochus stop these constant wars with Egypt immediately. It's a demand from Rome. Antiochus says, well, I'll have to discuss this with my friends and my generals. Gaius Lanus takes a stick, which he had in his hand at the time, and draws a circle in the sand around Antiochus. And he says, don't you dare move outside that circle until you give me an answer to how you're going to respond to that letter. whether you'll abide by its demands or whether you refuse to abide by its demands. Imagine how this individual felt, this great Antiochus Epiphanes. He called himself the glorious one. He called himself God manifest. And here's this Roman general. Rome isn't even a world power yet. It's on the rise, though, as is evident here, and was evident when Scipio met his father. Rome is on the rise, and it's clear that it's on the rise, and it's clear what power they already are wielding. That this great man Antiochus Epiphanes allows this general to draw a circle around him and command him not to move outside the circle before he gives him an answer. Antiochus accepts the demands and returns home. He can't attack Egypt anymore because the Romans will have him. He's made this promise. He's accepted the demands of the Roman general and the government of Rome. Where is he going to turn all his anger now? Can you imagine what it was like for him going back home after setting out to attack Egypt and then being told by a Roman general, no, you don't. No more will you engage in these constant wars against the Ptolemies. Rome obviously had interests in Egypt at that time. Of course, we read of that in history later on. What's he going to do with that anger that he goes back with? Well, he turns his attention to the Jewish people, doesn't he? This little nation called Judah, whose religion he despises because it's unlike any other religion. He hates it. He hates lots of religions. And he turns his attention to Palestine. Verse 30. And he is helped, just as he was in Egypt, by faithless Jews who work with him. Look at verse 30. Well, we read some of this already, haven't we? Sorry. He shall even return, this is the last part of verse 30. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. So there were people who gave him intelligence as he went into Judea, into Palestine, to attack and dismantle the Jewish culture and the Jewish religion. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate. And of course, we know the history of this, don't we? If you've ever read First Maccabees, which is very good history, it's part of the Apocrypha, but it's a very good history of this whole episode. Antiochus Epiphanes not only pollutes the temple and destroys much of the temple worship furniture, if you like, you know, sort of altars and so on, but he sets up a statue of Zeus, which was the Greek god, whom the Romans called Jupiter, Olympus. He sets up a statue of Zeus in the Holy of Holies in the temple and commands people no longer to worship the God of Israel, but only to worship Zeus, and to worship Zeus through sacrifices which were not permitted under the law. In other words, sacrificing swine and other animals. Many Jews followed him, partly through fear, partly through persecution, partly through because it was easier to do that than resist, and partly because they had no regard for the law of Moses as it was then. So there were Jews who worked with him, and there were Jews who had no alternative because of the threat of violence than to comply with his wishes. But of course we know that things turned again. Notice the verse 33. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. So this is talking about the history of the Maccabean revolt. Remember Mattathias, who reacted against the demand for him to sacrifice and an appropriate facilitated an appropriate sacrifice because he was a priest. He reacted against it. He killed the officer who was commanding him, one of Antiochus' generals, killed him, and also killed another Jew who was willing to perform this sacrifice to a false god. And he and his sons fled into the mountains, and that was the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. That's what's being described here. Notice also verse 33. Very important that we read this. It says, "And they that understand among the people shall instruct many." So although there was this great persecution, and he set out to destroy and did destroy pretty much every trace of the religion of Israel. He destroyed pretty much every trace of it, Antiochus did, but he couldn't destroy the faith of those who remained faithful. You can take away all the trappings of faith, can't you, if you're powerful enough. You can take away people's Bibles. You can take away the ability they have to meet together. You can take that away from them. You can take away their places of worship. You can take away all the peripheral things that are associated with worship. But you can't take away their faith. If they remain faithful, you can't take that away. And there were people among the Jews who continued to be faithful and teach each other these things and encourage each other. That continues. So there's a remnant continued even in spite of this persecution, which went on for a number of years until the Maccabees eventually ousted the Greeks and reclaimed the temple, rededicated it. So we have this history unfolding for us. Verse 34 and verse 35 continue this beginnings of the Maccabean revolt and this the start of the campaign to rid the country of the Greeks under Antiochus. Verse 35, "And some of them, understanding, shall fall and to try them, and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is not yet, because it is yet for an appointed time." Again, a reminder that some people resisted, some people remained faithful. They paid for that with their lives, many of them. They died in faith, many of them. They were put to death because of their faith. And God says here that, this was only for the time appointed. Reminding us that God is in control. Even though people are dying, even though men and women of faith are dying for their faith, and it seems like they have no hope, and this individual, this Antiochus, is having free reign. It seems like he can do whatever he likes, and he can stamp out religion from the entire country. Seems like he can just do whatever he pleases, yet it's only for a time appointed. It's a reminder to us that God is in control. And this only happens for a time. And of course, 3.5 or so years later, the Greeks were ousted from the region. All these things, of course, preparing the way for the coming of Christ. So there's this reminder to us that there's a purpose in all these things, that God was working out a purpose, that even though people of faith, men, women, maybe young people, were dying and being put to death for their faith, this was for a reason. All these things were preparing the way for the coming of the Christ and the rededication of the temple to which Christ came at his first coming. Verse 36, the story takes a strange twist for us, because it seems like we're continuing to read about the antics of Antiochus Epiphanes, but we're not. The story takes a strange twist because now we're reading about another individual, somebody of whom Antiochus is only a type. Remember the little horn that we met in chapter 7 of Daniel, the little horn that we said corresponded to the man of sin that Paul talks about in Ephesians. This is the individual who Daniel is now describing. No longer Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the other little horn that we read of in chapter 8 of Daniel. We're now looking at the little horn that we looked at in chapter 7 of Daniel. So from verse 36 onwards, there's a twist in the tale. "And the king shall do according to his will." Well, Antiochus didn't do everything that he wanted to do. "And he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every God. This is now talking about an individual that the Apostle Paul tells about, who is to rise up in the future, who, like Antiochus, will persecute God's people specifically. Other people too, who don't like him or don't, you know, or try to resist him, but specifically God's people. Another individual who will rise up like Antiochus, but greater than Antiochus, far greater than Antiochus. Paul describes him in Ephesians, which we looked at that recently. Shall magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. This individual who is going to rise up in the future will have no regard for any religion. Any. He'll call himself God, but no other religion will he have any regard for. No other gods will he have any time for or any regard for. He alone will consider himself to be God. Not the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all. This is an individual who's yet to step onto the world scene. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. In other words, what that's saying is that his only god, if he has any god at all, the only god he respects is the God of brute force. He admires that. And he wields it. He wields it wherever he goes. Brute force he admires. And brute force he wields. So if he is said to have any God at all, it's the God of force. But he regards himself as the only God. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. That's himself. He'll set himself up as God. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land for gain. Of course, the Apostle Paul in Ephesians tells us that it's himself who is proclaimed God. It's himself that he invites people to worship. He builds a temple for himself and he calls the temple of God. Why? To show to the world that he alone is God. Paul tells us those things. So Antiochus was only a type of this man we're now reading about. And he'll do exactly as he wants. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 4 depicts him very clearly. His temple that he builds will be called the temple of God to show to the world that he alone is God. And he trusts in nothing but his own might. Because we know the expression might is right. Well, he'll believe that fully. He'll believe that fully. That force is the only thing that people respect. And force is the only thing that he has any regard for. And if he has any God at all, apart from himself, it's force. It's brute force, verse 38. This is the only God. Brute force. Now we can press the literal language, we can't press the literal language as we go on through here too far. And we should know why we can't do that, because in many of the Old Testament prophecies, the way the prophets worded things was in the light of their own understanding, the light of their own culture, the light of their own scriptures. And we know from the New Testament, for example, in Acts chapter 2, where Peter preaches on the day of Pentecost, Peter says, when the events unfold at Pentecost, the Holy Spirit is poured out, and young men and women, believers, start preaching about God and telling the things that Jesus did, and many people are brought to faith through that preaching, Peter says, this is what Joel said. This is what Joel spoke. But if you read the prophecy of Joel, it doesn't sound like that at all. So we can't press the literal language of these things too far. For example, in verses 40, 41, where he talks about Moab and Edom, these were traditional enemies of God's people in the past, because there's no Moab now, and there hasn't been since, and there won't be in the future. But they're used here to represent those who stand against God, all of the enemies of God who will come at the end. Verses 40 to 41. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots. Again, don't press the literal language too much, because I don't think they'll have chariots for some reason. They'll have something else which is faster and more powerful. And like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen. Don't think they'll be using too many horses. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. And he shall enter, verse 41, into the glorious land. Remember, the Palestine then was regarded by the Jews as the glorious land. It no longer is glorious, far from it, but it was considered glorious then. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon, because they're also enemies of God's people. Those people working with him, of course, will escape. And he shall stretch forth his hand also to the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps, in other words, at his feet. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly take many away. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountains, between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. And he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. These things will only last for a time. They'll only last for a time. There was a time when Mount Zion was considered the holy mountain. It was, when Daniel writes, it was a holy place then. It's no longer a holy place now. There are no holy places now. We know that from the New Testament scriptures. We know that because of what Stephen told us before he was stoned to death. We know that because of what the Apostle Paul told us. And we know that because of what is written elsewhere, even in the Revelation. We know that the Mount Zion now, which is holy, is the heavenly Jerusalem. The earthly Jerusalem is no longer holy. So all these things, we have to be careful that we don't press the literal language too far in all of these Old Testament prophecies. But all of these things will come to an end. That's what we're told. After he puts down all rebellion, he comes to his end, and none shall help him. So this is the vision of the Antichrist that Paul talks about in 2 Thessalonians. So what lessons can we learn, just in closing? What lessons can we learn from all of this? I guess the first lesson that we learn is that day will come. That day will come. We probably can't picture it exactly, but maybe we can. The way things are unfolding on the world scene, I suppose anything's possible now. We may, at one time, we may have wondered, oh, how could that happen? How could this happen? I remember sort of when I was working years ago, I think I was still in my 20s, about 24 years old, and I was talking to a lad at work, and we were talking about Russia. And I mentioned to him, I said that maybe Germany will unite, maybe East and West Germany. He said, no chance. He said, the Russians would never allow that. They would never allow that to happen. I said, well, you never know. He said, they'll never allow that to happen. Russia's far too powerful. What happened since then? Germany reunited. The Berlin Wall came down. You know, the Russian Empire splintered. You never would have thought those things would happen. But now we see things more faster paced even than then, don't we? On the world scene. So anything's happened. Anything could happen. And so although at one time we might have wondered about these things, this day will come. This individual will rise. You know, the four empires that we read of in Daniel chapter 2 and in Daniel chapter 4, these four empires, God sees them as one. Remember that each empire that succeeded the other, assimilated the previous one. So that God sees them as one empire. And when the final empire arises, we know the fourth empire is Rome. When the final empire arises, it appears to be Rome. We don't know how, but it appears to be Rome. And appears to be composed of those multiplicity of nations into which the Roman Empire disintegrated. We don't know exactly how these are going to be, but it'll be by force. It won't be a union. It won't be a happy union. It'll be by force. This individual will do these things by force. He will annex these countries by force. He'll create this empire by force. These things will happen. These things will occur. There will be a day when this individual will rise up. And many of the things that we read here that we can't fully understand, we'll understand them then. Because sometimes in prophecy, as we just mentioned with the day of Pentecost, sometimes prophecies become clear when the events happen. Then you think to yourself, that's what was meant when those things were written. That's what Daniel meant. Now I see it. Now I see what this individual was meant to do. Now I see how these things were meant to unfold. So we can learn that there is an appointed time. And these days will come. Verse 27, verse 29, verse 35, verse 36, all talk about the appointed time. There's a time when Antiochus was to come on the scene, and he did come on the scene, and he did cause havoc, and he did persecute God's people, and he did destroy the religion of Israel, but it was only for a time. The Maccabees ousted the Greeks shortly afterwards. How did they do that? A group of people who fled to the mountains and carried on a terror campaign against the Greeks, the most powerful empire in the world at the time, and ousted them from the country. Judas Maccabeus, the son of Mattathias, who became such a great military commander and was able to attack the Greeks at their weakest spots so brutally and so quickly and so decisively that he was given the nickname the Hammer, which is what Maccabees means, the Hammer, Maccabeus. He became known as the Hammer. He really drove them out of the country through this concerted campaign of terrorism. So there was a time when he rose, there was a time when he went. Antiochus met his end, and no one was there to help him. He had all these friends at one point, friends in Egypt, friends in Israel, but when his time came, there was no one to help him. And this individual will also rise, but will only be for a time. Only for a time. Well, we can't go into chapter 12. We can do if we want to, but chapter 12 has a lot to say about that time. But for us, we learn that these things are only for a time, and God is in control. God is still in control. Verse 45, he'll come to his end. All of history is in God's hands, and God will deal with this man as he dealt with Antiochus Epiphanes, as he dealt with Adolf Hitler, as he dealt with all the madmen of history. He'll come to his end. God is in control. All history is in God's hands. But remember what I said in verse 31, but the people that know their God, he can't take your faith away. Those who are alive at the time when this man comes on the scene will find persecution. We may even be martyred by him. We may even find our death through him. Or friends of ours, or family of ours, relations of ours might. But he can take away your life. He can't take away your faith. That's what God's saying here, that there will be a remnant. God's people will survive. The gospel will be preserved even in spite of the persecution. The church might cease to exist. Visibly, the world will see that the church is gone. He's destroyed it. He's got rid of it. Just as there was a point in history where Antiochus Epiphanes had destroyed the religion of Israel. It was gone. But then it came back. Because there were some people who were faithful. And they kept the faith and kept encouraging each other and teaching each other and sharpening each other. And when the time came, the temple was rededicated. The nation was reestablished. And Jesus came to that temple that was rededicated. So the gospel will be preserved. And we can be absolutely certain that although these things are destined to happen, prophesied to happen, and will happen, this individual who will arise will not have the last word. Amen to that.